Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Daniel chapter 11. I will cover verses 31 through 45, the last of three audios on this one chapter, this very difficult chapter. If you recall, Daniel was prophesying in the third year of Cyrus, which puts him right around 136, 135 BC, the third year that Cyrus had ruled Babylon. Daniel, of course, survived the transition from the Babylonian Empire to the Persian Empire. He's working for the Persians now when he had this vision. And the vision, as described in Daniel 11:31, refers to the Greco-Syrian wars, the wars of the Diadochi, the successes of Alexander the Great. And Daniel has gone into great detail talking about the kings of the north, that's the Seleucids, or the Seleucids, and the kings of the south, it's the Ptolemies. And his history, his prophecy actually tracks the history perfectly, so well, in fact, that liberals think that Daniel must have written it after the fact, which, of course, we don't believe. He prophesied it. And during these wars of the Diadochi, we're down to the time of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, where we left off in our last audio, ending in verse 30 of chapter 11. Now, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes ruled from 175 to 164. His main opponent in Egypt was the Ptolemy the Sixth Philometor, who ruled from 180 to 145. So the two were roughly contemporaneous, except that Antiochus the Fourth died a good bit before Ptolemy the Sixth Philometor. But that's who the main conflict is now, as we begin in Daniel 11, verse 31. Forces from him, that's Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who ruled from 175 to 164, forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. Now, this refers to one or both of the returns from Egypt that Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes made as he was going down there to try to conquer the Egyptian kingdom, take it away from Ptolemy the Sixth Philometor. And he made two trips down there and left Egypt, going back to Antioch in Syria, where his capital was, and he had to travel through Jerusalem on the way. And on those two trips, one in 169 and one in 168 BC, on those two trips, he did a number on Israel. And so he's become very famous in Jewish history. So let's look at some of the stuff he did. Now, I am not going to try to straighten out what he did on which trip. That is in the weeds for me. A lot of scholars argue that he did this then and he did that at another time. Well, let's see how Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes desecrated the sanctuary fortress. I assume it's called a fortress because the walls of the temple were fortified. Here's what Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes did. His army desecrated the temple. They stopped the daily sacrifices. They built a pagan altar over the altar of burnt offering. They placed an image of Zeus Olympus upon the altar of burnt offering. And on the 15th of Kislev in December 168 BC, swine's flesh was offered on the altar to Zeus. Soldiers themselves were not clean, and they entered the temple. The temple was filled with riot and reveling by the Gentiles. The Gentiles, the Syrians, fornicated with harlots and women within the circuit of the holy places. So this is a very terrible visitation by Antiochus the Fourth. He did away with the regular sacrifice. That means the morning and evening sacrifice, the famous morning and evening sacrifice. And then Antiochus the Fourth's forces will set up the abomination of desolation. Now that name is, of course, very familiar for students of prophecy. Abomination has anything to do with idolatry. The abomination of desolation probably means the abomination which causes desolation. Jerusalem was made a wilderness because of the abominations done within the city. Now, what the abomination actually was is debated. One option is it was a garrison of heathen soldiers in the temple, or other people say it was the idol of Zeus that was put in the temple. I think that's most probably what it is. In fact, the Apocrypha, the Maccabees, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, states that this was the abomination putting that in the temple, so we'll go with that. Now, there's one thing we need to remember. This is not the same abomination of desolation that we read about in Luke's version of the Olivet Discourse. That was the incursion of Roman armies around Jerusalem that desecrated the land of Israel with their pagan standards and their pagan cells. Just because the same phrase is used doesn't mean the same thing is being referred to. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 32. With flattery he, that's Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, will corrupt those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will be strong and take action. Well, what kind of flattery did Antiochus the Fourth use? Well, after he desecrated the temple, he decreed that his entire kingdom should become one people. And so each of the constituent peoples of his empire would have to give up their own customs. Now, other people under Antiochus the Fourth's rule accepted that, but of course a hardcore Jew is not going to accept that. He's going to be loyal to the Torah. But because of Antiochus the Fourth's flattery, many of the Israelites also forsook the law and adopted his pagan religion. And so the corruption that Daniel is speaking of is talking about the corruption of Jews who act wickedly toward the covenant. In other words, they abandon the Torah, the covenant, Mosaic covenant. But the people who know their God will be strong and take action. Now, the people who know their God are the famous Maccabeans, the Maccabees. As John Gill says, the Maccabees endured racks and tortures, all sorts of punishment and death in every shape. Famous story. What was the corruption that the Maccabees were fighting against? Well, Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, had commanded a change in all the ordinances of God. No sacrifices were to be offered in the sanctuary. The Sabbath and feast were to be profaned. The Jews were not to circumcise their sons. The Jews were commanded to profane the true religion so that eventually the law would be forgotten. And if they didn't do all this, they would be executed. So yes, Antiochus the Fourth corrupted those who went along with that. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 33. Those who are wise among the people will give understanding to many, yet they will die by sword and flame and be captured and plundered for a time. Those who are wise will die. That's probably the Maccabees. Could be the people in general. But the wise give understanding to many. That sounds like the Maccabees explaining the cost of compromise to their fellow Jews, yet they will die by sword. Here's what the deal was, as recorded by Josephus. Being continually harassed and enduring grievous punishments, they died. Some were scourged and their bodies mutilated, and being yet alive and breathing were crucified. Women and their children whom they crucified were by the king's orders strangled and hanged about the necks of their parents that were crucified. Whoever was found in possession of a Torah was put to death. Women who had their children circumcised were put to death. Along with the entire families of those who had been circumcised were put to death. And also those who had circumcised the babies were put to death. So they will die by sword and they will die by flame. Daniel says in verse 33, some of the Maccabees were burnt alive in caves where they were hidden. Some were thrown into heated cauldrons of brass. We read in 2 Maccabees 7, verses 3 through 5, then the king, being in a rage, commanded pans and cauldrons to be made hot, which forthwith being heated, he commanded to cut out the tongue of him that spake first, and to cut off the utmost parts of his body, the rest of his brethren and his mother looking on. Now when he was thus maimed in all his members, he commanded him, being yet alive, to be brought to the fire, and to be fried in the pan. And as the vapor of the pan was for a good space dispersed, they exhorted one another with the mother to die manfully. These are tortures that are almost hard to imagine. Daniel says that the wise, probably the Maccabees, will be captured. Women and children were sold into slavery by Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. They will be plundered for a time. The Maccabees had their houses rifled and their goods taken away. Now, the time that all this happened is said by Josephus to be 3.5 years in his book, The Antiquities. And, of course, that 3.5 years is attractive to people who study prophecy because of how many times it's mentioned in the book of Revelation. I don't know. I haven't pursued that little tidbit of information. I'm just going to assume that the persecution lasted for a while and then it stopped as Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes goes back to Antioch and leaves his troops behind him. His persecution stopped, of course, in 164, which coincidentally was the same year he died, but was also the time that the Maccabees got back control of Jerusalem and purified the temple. 25 Kislev, 164 BC, Hanukkah, the first Hanukkah rededication of the temple. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 34. When defeated, they will be helped by some, but many others will join them insincerely. Now, Daniel, in verse 34, refers to some who will help. Some who will help. They will be helped by some. When defeated, that means when the Jews were defeated by Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, they will be helped by some Maccabees, but many others will join them insincerely. Well, let's see what the history behind this is. Of course, the decrees of Antiochus IV eventually led to a rebellion. That rebellion was started by the priest Mattathias and his five sons. One of his sons was Judas Maccabee. Mattathias and his family had fled from Jerusalem to Modin when the Seleucid forces took the city. There, Mattathias killed a Jew who was sacrificed according to Antiochus IV's command, a compromiser. From this first act of rebellion, a guerrilla war against the forces of Antiochus IV began. Judas Maccabee defeated the large army of Antiochus IV's general Apollonius. This is after Mattathias' father had died in 167 BC. The victory helped Judas Maccabee to gather a sizable force. However, only a minority of the soldiers were actually faithful men. That's the reference here in verse 34 of Daniel. Many others will join them insincerely or hypocritically. Now, as John Gill says, the Maccabees were not able to restore the land to its former glory and liberty, although great exploits were indeed done by the Maccabees, considering their number and strength. They were a small number, but they did a lot of very brave stuff. But this help for the Jews did not last long. The enemy returned with great fierceness and cruelty, and even after the Seleucids were gone, Israel eventually fell to the Romans in 37 BC. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 35. Some of the wise will fall so that they may be refined, purified, and cleansed until the end of the end. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 35. Some of the wise will fall so that they may be refined, purified, and cleansed until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. Now, what does this refer to? Probably when the Gentile nations around Judea heard of their victory over the Seleucids, they began to kill those Jews who lived among them. And Judas Maccabee and his brother Simon fought and defeated those Gentiles. So some of the wise will fall, that some of the Jews who hold to the covenant were being persecuted by their Gentile neighbors. They will fall so that they may be refined. Some of the people that fell would include Judas Maccabee, who was killed in battle in 161 BC. 3 years after the first Hanukkah. And after Judas Maccabee was killed, as a result, many wicked Jews started persecuting righteous Jews. Now, all of this refinement and purification and cleansing is said by Daniel to last until the time of the end. The end of what? Four options here. I'm going to put them in chronological order. Option number one, the end of the time of trial brought about by Antiochus IV's Epiphanes depredations. Remember, the temple was rededicated, Kislev 25:164, so we could say until then. Option number two, the refinement and purification will last till the end of the Seleucid dynasty, which lasted from 312 to 63 BC when the Romans knocked it off in 63. Option number three, all of this is going to go until the end of the Hasmonean dynasty, which lasted between 140, the Hasmoneans were the successors of the Maccabees, from 140 to 37 BC. And I think that's the correct answer because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the Maccabees, which is the Hasmoneans, really. And it makes sense to think that Daniel is speaking of the end of that period of history. Option number four, Daniel is speaking of the end of the 70 weeks of Daniel. The middle of the 70th week was 30 A.D. when Jesus was crucified. The end was 33 A.D. And then, of course, after that, in Daniel 12, you get the, and also in Daniel 9, you get the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in A.D. 70. But I think option number three is the best. It's the end of the Hasmonean dynasty, so we will go with that. That is the time in which the wise, i.e. the Maccabees, will be refined, purified, and cleansed. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 36 through 38. Now, I need to point out that we are finished with talking about verses that clearly refer to Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Verse 35 is the last such verse. Everybody agrees. Antiochus IV Epiphanes, no problem. 175 to 164. His two excursions through Jerusalem in 169 and 168, not a problem. But now, when we get to verse 36 and we go to verse 45, the end of the chapter, is where all sorts of confusion and disagreement and fogginess occurs. So let me read you verses 36 through 38. Then the king will do whatever he wants. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and he will say outrageous things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, because what has been decreed will be accomplished. He will not show regard for the gods of his fathers, the god longed for by women, or the desire of women, as some translations have it, or for any other god, because he will magnify himself above all. Instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god his fathers did not know, with gold, silver, precious stones, and riches. So the $64 million question here is in verse 36, who is this king who will do whatever he wants? Now, the King James translates that as the willful king. He does what he wills, he does what he wants, so he's the willful king. I'm going to use that term because it's shorter than the king who will do whatever he wants. Who is this willful king? Well, here's some options. I'm going to give you five, but I'm going to narrow the options down to three in just a minute. The first is the king is still talking about Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. We just continue right on from verse 35. That's option one. Option number two is talking about Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who is a type of the future Antichrist. Option number three, it's not talking about Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. It's just talking about the future Antichrist. Option number four, it's Herod the Great, the same Herod that tried to kill Jesus. Option number five is the institution of the Roman Emperor, which is a little fuzzy. That's John Gill's idea. Well, I'm going to throw out Gill's idea, and I'm going to consolidate these options into three options. The first option is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. The second option is the end of the world, future Antichrist, and the third option is Herod the Great. I'm going to give you a heads up. I believe it's Herod the Great. Well, let's start with Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now, many people have adopted this option. There are certain things in the description in verses 36 following that remind one of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. In verse 36, he called himself a god. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god. That does sound like Antiochus the Fourth. He profaned the temple. That fits in with exalting and magnifying himself above every god. He profaned Yahweh's temple. In verse 36, he spoke monstrous things about and against the God of gods. He issued a decree forbidding the worship of Jehovah. That's pretty monstrous. But the best argument for Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes is that the immediately preceding context spoke of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, and so we just flow right on into the next passage. But here are the arguments against Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And folks, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes just does not fit verses 36 through 45. First of all, in verse 37, the willful king is said not to show regard for the gods of his fathers. Well, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, as a matter of historical fact, actually did show regard for the gods of his fathers. Who were his gods? The Seleucid dynasty had two patron gods, Apollos and Zeus. Apollos was the patron and ancestor of the Seleucid dynasty. Antiochus the Fourth never dishonored those gods. And, of course, all the other Greek gods besides Apollos and Zeus were part of the pantheon of the Seleucids because they were Greeks and they were pagans. Now, this is how Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes showed regard for his father's gods. Now, I'm quoting from a dispensationalist, Mark Mercer. It's rare that I find common cause with a dispensationalist, but I do so here. Let me list some of the things that Mr. Mercer says that are factors which show that Antiochus the Fourth does not fit this passage, and that Antiochus the Fourth actually did show regard for his father's gods, even though Daniel said that the willful king would not show regard for his father's gods. Number one, Antiochus the Fourth resumed the construction of the Temple of Zeus in Athens. That shows regard. Antiochus the Fourth made contributions to the Temple of Zeus in Olympia. That's in Greece. Well, Athens is too, but Olympia's to the south and west of Athens. He built a temple for Jupiter Capitolinus, who's the Roman Zeus, at Antioch in Syria. So he's building temples all over the place for pagan gods. He contributed to the building or the rebuilding of the temple of Apollo at Daphne. Daphne is a suburb of Antioch. His edict of 167 BC involved the introduction of the Dionysus cult, so he gave honor to Dionysus as well as Apollo and Zeus. At the games of 166, there were a number of images and a procession at Daphne. Following those games, Apollo was honored with a new coinage of gold coins. So was Antiochus the Fourth of Epiphanes given regard for his fathers? I think so. Antiochus also contributed some statues around the altar at Delos, which is the island in the Aegean Sea where the Athenians kept their treasury. Delos was thought to be the birthplace of Apollo and was considered sacred to him, and so Antiochus put some statues there. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that does it for me. This willful king cannot be Antiochus the Fourth of Epiphanes. And even if Antiochus the Fourth of Epiphanes did not show regard for gods of his fathers, in other words, if you can get around those arguments I just mentioned, even still, it would have been no big deal for Antiochus the Fourth of Epiphanes to switch allegiance to his gods, because rulers back then did that for political reasons all the time. So it would have been a truism, a commonplace, to say, hey, this willful king is going to not show regard for his gods. That would not be an event of prophetic significance, because kings all the time, pagan kings all the time, didn't show regard for the gods of their fathers. But if this willful king is a Jewish guy, or at least an ostensibly Jewish guy, as Herod the Great was, him not showing regard for his fathers would be a big deal and would be worthy of taking note in the prophecy. All right, so that's the first reason why Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes does not fit these last 10 verses of Daniel 11, but also Antiochus the Fourth didn't die at the right place. We read in Daniel 11, verse 45, he will pitch his royal tents between the sea and the beautiful holy mountain, but he will meet his end with no one to help him. In other words, he's going to die in Israel. The sea is the Mediterranean Sea. The beautiful holy mountain is Mount Zion in Jerusalem. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes did not die in Israel. History records that he died in Persia. Let me read from Wikipedia. Taking advantage of Antiochus's Western problems, King Mithridates I of Parthia, Parthia is the empire that's basically in southern Russia, Armenia, between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, and also further to the east. So King Mithridates I of Parthia attacked from the east and said, King Mithridates I of Parthia attacked from the east and seized the city of Herat, that's modern-day Afghanistan, in 167 BC, disrupting the direct trade route to India and effectively splitting the Greek world in two. Recognizing the potential danger in the east, but unwilling to give up control of Judea, Antiochus sent a commander named Lysias to deal with the Maccabees, while the king himself led the main Seleucid army against the Parthians. After initial success in his eastern campaign, including the reoccupation of Armenia, Antiochus died suddenly of a disease in 164 BC. So, Antiochus dies in Armenia or somewhere around Armenia, whereas Daniel says the willful king died in Israel, between the sea and the beautiful holy mountain. Reason number three, why verses 36 through 45 of Daniel 11 do not apply to Antiochus Epiphanes IV. That king could not do as he pleased. He was not a willful king who could do whatever he wanted. He was curbed by the Romans. In fact, in my last audio, I talked about how Popilius Lenus, the Roman guy, kicked Antiochus IV out of Egypt. The day of Eleusis, they were at a little place outside of Alexandria, and the Romans said, you need to quit trying to take over Egypt, Antiochus. You need to leave. And Antiochus said, well, give me a night to think about it. And Popilius draws a line in the sand, a circle around Antiochus, and said, I need your answer before you leave this circle. That incident is so famous that it's given us the expression, I'm drawing a line in the sand. That doesn't sound like a king who could do as he pleased. Folks, the willful king is not Antiochus IV Epiphanes. In fact, the evidence is so much against him that futurists say, well, it's not Antiochus IV, so it must be the end of the world Antichrist. Now here, I agree with the dispensationalist and the futurist who say that it cannot be Antiochus IV Epiphanes, but are we to just say that Daniel all of a sudden jumps from Antiochus IV Epiphanes in verse 35, that king dying in 164, and Daniel would jump from there to thousands of years in the future? There's a huge chronological gap in the narrative. As Philip Morrow, in his great book, The 70 Weeks in the Great Tribulation, says in chapter 9, a straightforward narrative in continuous historical order, omitting no happening of any importance, precludes the idea of there being any break. Hear, hear. Mr. Morrow, I agree totally. So the big chronological gap is the big weakness in the end-of-the-world Antichrist theory. Also, another problem is the prophecy itself states that the subject of the prophecy were the last days of Jewish history. The introduction to verse 11 was in Daniel 10, and we read in Daniel 10:14, "Now I have come to help you understand," this is Gabriel, "I have come to help you, Daniel, understand what will happen to your people," the Jews, "in the last days, for the vision refers to those days." Now, of course, the futurists will say, "Oh, that's talking about the end of the world, the last days." Well, for 35 verses in Daniel 11, last days is referred to the Greco-Syrian wars, because Daniel 10:14 says that. I'm talking about what's going to happen to you in the last days. And then he goes into great detail about the north and the south, the kings of the north, the kings of the south, the kings of the north being the Seleucids, the kings of the south being the Ptolemies. The last days is all about the last days of the Jewish kingdom. Why would the meaning for last days all of a sudden change in verse 36 to last days of the world? I don't think so. So that leaves us with option number 3, which in my opinion is the correct option. Herod the Great is the willful king. Now let's briefly look at an argument from the description of the king, how that description most probably applies to Herod the Great, and then we will look at an argument from the immediately preceding context. The description of the king. Daniel is interested in Syrian wars only as they relate to Israel, so he refers to the combatant kings with geographical reference to Israel. The Seleucids are king of the north, the Ptolemies are king of the south, because Syria was to the north of Israel and Egypt was to the south of Israel. But when he gets to the willful king in verse 36, Daniel does not use a geographical reference to this willful king. He simply calls him king. Why? Because the king was neither north or south of Israel. He was in Israel. Let me go back to verse 36. Daniel says, "Then the king will do whatever he wants." Not the king of the north or the king of the south. Then the king. He's talking about Herod here. Herod, by the way, ruled from 37 B.C. to 4 B.C., ruled Israel. Now let's look at another argument that states that the willful king is Herod. We'll look at the immediately preceding context, verses 32 through 35, which I covered in the last audio. Those verses, those immediately preceding verses, refer to the Jews and their situation during and after the Maccabean revolt. Remember in verse 35 said that this revolt would last until the end time. Verse 35 says this, "Some of the wise will fall so that they may be refined, purified, and cleansed until the time of the end." Well, and I said that the time of the end is probably referring to the end of the Maccabean revolt, because that's what Daniel is talking about. He's talking about the Maccabean revolt. Well, that ended in 37 B.C. And exactly when did Herod the Great begin to reign? 37 B.C. The Herodian dynasty ran from 37 B.C. to 92 A.D. All of that's in Wikipedia. Well, that's more than a coincidence, I think. The time of the end, verse 35, end of the Maccabean revolt. And so then we go to the next stage of history, which is Herod the Great in verse 37. Now let's go to this phrase, "the king will do whatever he wants," in verse 36. Now that means more than just that the king will do what he wants. That's true of every king. So if you take it that loosely, this gives no clue as to a specific person. But what it means is this willful king will be a successful conqueror and ruler who maneuvers without hindrance. A king who does whatever he wants was a phrase that was used to describe two previous successful conquerors by Daniel, Alexander the Great in Daniel 11:3. "Then a warrior king will arise. He will rule a vast realm and do whatever he wants." So Alexander the Great was a willful king. And then Antiochus the Great, who ruled from 223 to 187. In Daniel 11:16, Daniel says, "The king of the north who comes against him will do whatever he wants," the king of the north being Antiochus III the Great, "and no one can oppose him." So Herod is going to be a conqueror. We will see from Herod's history, and by the way, you should read Herod's biography. There's a great biography out. I forgot the name of the guy who wrote it. I think he was a Jewish guy, but it just came out within the last 10 years or so, I think. This guy was a fine piece of work. He was a fine schemer, a manipulator, and a politician. He was from Idumea, which used to be called Edom, to the south of Israel. Idumea had been conquered by the Hasmoneans between 140 and 130 B.C. His father had ingratiated himself with the Hasmoneans, and his wife was Mariamne, who was an Idumean Hasmonean, so he married into the Hasmonean family and thus identified with the Jews pretty closely, even though he himself was from Idumea, an Edomite, if you will, which is not exactly an Israelite. Herod's father appointed Herod governor of Galilee at the age of 25. That was in 47 B.C. His father had obtained power in Israel through his father's connections with the Romans. Now, as the Hasmoneans were beginning to lose power, remember this is at the time of the rise of Rome. The Romans actually conquered Israel in 63 B.C., leaving the Hasmoneans behind as titular leaders, although the Romans were the real power. But they're losing power, and so Herod begins to see that his bread is not buttered by the Hasmoneans anymore, so he starts ingratiating himself with Mark Antony, who was the Roman general in charge of the East. And Mark Antony appointed Herod tetrarch over Judea in 41 B.C. Herod, of course, paid him a bribe so that he could get that. And in 40 B.C., Herod was elected king of the Jews by the Roman Senate. But Herod was not on site in Jerusalem. He was in exile in Rome because the Parthians had conquered Jerusalem at that time. The Parthians installed a Hasmonean named Antigonus as the titular ruler, and Herod didn't get his kingdom till he defeated Antigonus in 37 B.C., and that was the end of the Hasmonean dynasty. So you see, Herod moved from being pro-Hasmonean to anti-Hasmonean and pro-Mark Antony. So now Herod is the client of Mark Antony. Of course, he was the Eastern Roman emperor who fought the great civil war with Octavius, who later became the great Caesar Augustus. They had a definitive battle in 31 B.C. at Actium off the west coast of Greece. And now Herod is sort of in a mess because he's backed the wrong horse. But Herod the Great forced his way back into Octavian's confidence with his smooth talk. Octavius went on down to Egypt after Actium so he could knock off Mark Antony and Cleopatra, and on the way he went through Israel, and Herod gave him all kinds of gifts, sucked up to him, flattered him, and I think it was somewhere else in Asia Minor that he went to Herod. I'm speaking from memory here, but he went to Octavius and begged him for continued rule in Israel, and Octavius said, "Why should I trust you?" And Herod said, "Oh, but when I was serving your enemy, Mark Antony, I served him well. I was loyal. Mark Antony never had to worry about me betraying him, and that's the way I am. So if I followed him so well, I'll do the same with you." And Octavius was so impressed that he gave Herod the Great rule over Israel after the Battle of Actium in 31. So you see how Herod is a fantastic politician, a manipulator, a schemer. Now, here is a gentleman named De Priest who's quoting Philip Morrow. And by the way, let me give you some sources as to who believes that this is Herod the Great, the willful king. There's Philip Morrow. Now, Philip Morrow was a lawyer back in the early 1900s. I think it was 1922 he published a book. It was basically a critique of dispensationalism. It was called The 70 Weeks in the Great Tribulation. And in Chapter 9, he covered Chapter 11 of Daniel, and he was about to republish, I think it was 1944, when he ran across a book by a Scottish preacher named Farquharson, and had a long, long, long title like they did in the early 1800s. And Gary DeMar, who believes that the willful king is Herod the Great, he read Morrow's statement that Morrow had used Farquharson. So DeMar says, "Well, I want to use that book too. That would be very helpful to my case." And he couldn't find the book. He looked everywhere. So DeMar had a cousin that was in charge of the Princeton Seminary Library and said, "Could you find this book for me?" So the librarian and his cohorts searched and searched and searched and searched, and they came back to Gary DeMar and said, "I'm sorry, this title is an internet hoax. It doesn't exist." And DeMar said, "What do you mean it doesn't exist? It was quoted in a book in 1922, and the internet didn't exist then." So the librarian went back and searched and searched and searched, and they finally found two copies, one in Scotland and one in England, I think it was. At any rate, it's on the internet now, and I've downloaded it. So you got Farquharson, And then you got Gary DeMauro, American Division in Atlanta, who believes this. You got Philip Morrow. Philip Morrow is interesting, too. He was a prominent and well-established lawyer who used to argue cases before the United States Supreme Court. And he was walking by a gospel mission house one time, a bunch of poor people, you know, Salvation Army type of people banging the tambourines and singing. And all of a sudden, he had to go in. He went in, and God saved him. Morrow was also on the Carpathian, the ship that picked up some of the survivors of the Titanic disaster. He's an interesting guy, good writer. So Morrow, DeMar, and Farquharson are the guys you want to go to if you want to see the Herod the Great view. Now I'm going to quote from a guy named DePriest who is quoting from Morrow. He says that doing as he pleases is what distinguished Herod the Great in a remarkable degree. Notable. It is notable how successful Herod was in rising up from a lowly origin to be king, in securing despotic power and retaining it through all the political changes of the times. Herod secured at one time or another the favor and confidence of the great worthies of the Roman Empire. First of Julius Caesar, I didn't mention him. Then he was buddies with Mark Antony, and then he was buddies with Augustus Caesar. That's even though he had assisted Antony and Cleopatra against him, as we'll see in just a minute. Herod turned the Second Temple into one of the marvels of the ancient world. So Solomon's Temple really became Herod's Temple. That's why they write biographies about Herod the Great. He's an interesting guy. He was an evil, filthy guy, but he wasn't called the Great for nothing. Now contrast Herod the Great, the willful king, the king who does as he pleases, with Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Did Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth do as he pleased? He was conquered by the Jews. The Jews beat him. The Maccabees eventually beat him. Herod the Great conquered the Jews. He could do whatever he wants. But Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes was conquered by the Jews. He couldn't do whatever he wants. Now Herod the Great, also another argument that says that he did what he pleased. He was ruthless and cruel in doing what he willed. He did not hesitate to murder those who he considered to be threats to his rule. He murdered practically almost the entire Hasmonean line. He murdered those closest to him, his own family. Herod had his beloved wife Mariamne executed on a trumped-up charge of adultery. He had three of his own sons executed because he suspected them of conspiring to take his throne. Herod the Great actually, in fact, did whatever he pleased, whatever he wanted. He was a willful king. In verse 36, Daniel says he exalted himself above every god. Now that may be taken to mean every ruler and authority in Israel, because we know that God can sometimes mean secular authority. As Jesus said, you yourself have said we are gods, referring to the leaders of Israel. Herod the Great successfully aspired to lordship over every authority in Israel, whether priest or ruler. He assumed to appoint whom he would to the office of high priest. He put his own brother-in-law, Aristobulus, that's his wife Mariamne's brother, in the office of high priest, and then after that he had him murdered. So he put himself above every ruler and authority. He didn't really claim that he was divine, so we have to take that God there as he put himself over every ruler and authority, but that's perfectly okay. The word for God there is El. That can mean Yahweh, the true God, or it can mean a false god, an idol, or it can be a mighty one, a warrior, a hero, or it can mean a political leader. Now, one of my commentators speculates that God could mean a mighty one, and that the God being referred to is Nero, and Nero appointed every high priest in Israel, Nero being the emperor of the Roman Empire. And one of those high priests that was appointed was Aristobulus, Mariamne's brother. And then Herod killed Aristobulus, had him drowned. And that murder can be interpreted as Herod exalting himself over Nero. I think that's somewhat of a speculation, but I just mention it for interest. Now in verse 36, this willful king spoke outrageous things. Outrageous things against the God of gods. When did Herod speak outrageous things against the God of gods? Philip Morrow says that would include, not exclusively, but it would include the slaughter of the innocents. Of course, that's the famous time when Herod tried to kill all the little babies under 2 years old so he could kill the Messiah. Now, the willful king is said to say outrageous things. If you want to get technical about it, you could say, well, Herod said outrageous things when he asked the wise men where the baby Jesus was. He asked with an intent to murder. Herod spoke these outrageous things against the God of gods. That fits Herod. He tried to kill God's Messiah in the slaughter of the innocents. Now at the end of verse 36 in Daniel 11, The willful king will be successful until the time of wrath is completed. Jameson, Vossett, and Brown says that the time of wrath is completed when the wrath of God against the Jews for their rebellion against God was complete. Well, that's sort of general. It doesn't give us a time frame. Philip Morrow says this is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem. The problem is, of course, is that the verse 36 says that Herod is speaking outrageous things until this time of the end. Well, Herod didn't last AD 70. He died in 4 BC. The answer to that, according to Morrow, is that the dynasty of Herod lasted all the way till AD 70. And the dynasty of Herod opposed God all the way to the end. We know that by reading the Gospels. Herod Antipas killed John the Baptist. Herod Agrippa I in Acts killed James, the brother of John. Herod Agrippa I imprisoned Peter, intending to deliver him to the Jews. Herod Agrippa II sent Paul in chains to Rome in the 60s AD at the end of Acts. The Herods were opposed to God from the get-go all the way through until the time of the end. I don't know if Morrow's right about that, but I think it's a reasonable speculation. Now in verse 37, the willful king will not show regard for the gods of his fathers. I've already discussed that. That could not refer to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who did, as a matter of fact, show regard for the gods of his fathers. How did Herod not show regard for the gods of his fathers? First of all, we need to see how closely Herod identified with the Jewish people. In addressing the people, Herod habitually used the expression, our fathers, so he totally identified with Jews. We read that in Josephus' Antiquities. So fully was Herod regarded as a Jew that the Herodians even held him to be the Messiah, according to one of my sources. So, not showing regard for the gods of your fathers, that cannot refer to a pagan guy, because none of the pagan guys showed respect for the gods of their fathers. But for a Jewish guy, a Jewish king to do that, that stands out. How did Herod show no regard for Yahweh? Well, he tried to kill Yahweh's Messiah. That's how he showed no regard for the gods of his fathers. Now, let's talk about a potential problem with this interpretation. I've already mentioned that Herod was an Edomian, which is just another way of saying an Edomite. And, of course, the Edomites came from Esau, which was not from Jacob's branch coming out of Jacob. And so they were not part of the chosen covenant people. So how can we call Herod a Jew? We need to call him a Jew, of course, because he doesn't show regard for the gods of his fathers, his Jewish fathers. Well, here is the answer as to how we can call Herod a Jew. All of the remaining Idumeans had been amalgamated with the Jews. They had come into Judea several centuries previous, as Josephus says in Antiquities. And as I said earlier, in addressing the people, Herod habitually used the expression, our fathers. And as I said earlier, so fully was Herod regarded as a Jew that the Herodians even held him to be the Messiah. Well, even if Herod is not considered a Jew, but is considered rather an Edomian, and thus would not fit the description of a willful king who didn't regard the gods of his fathers, but even if you consider him an Edomian and not a Jew, the fathers of the Edomians was the same God, Yahweh, as the father of the Jews. Esau was Jacob's twin brother. Esau, of course, was the head of the Edomites, and the Edomites were the Edomians. So the God of Esau was the same God of Jacob, and so Herod would show no regard for the God of his fathers, even considered as an Edomian, because he tried to kill Yahweh's Messiah. Now, in verse 37, the Holman Christian Study Bible says that the willful king will not show regard for the God longed for by women. Now, that is a controversial translation, so let me give you some other possibilities. The Young's Literal Translation, the American Standard Version, the Darby Translation, the KJV, and the NASB translated as, he will show no regard for the desire of women. The Bible in Basic English says, he will show no regard for the God desired by women. Of course, that God could be interpreted as the Messiah, so Herod would be showing no regard for Jesus the Messiah because he tried to kill him. God's Word translation says that the willful king will have no desire for women. The New American Bible says the willful king will have no regard for the one in whom women delight. Well, I think the best way to take that, the desire of women, was the Messiah, because all women wanted to have the Messiah. If you translate it as the God desired by women, well, that God would be the Messiah. The NAB has the one in whom women delight. That would be the Messiah. They all wanted to have the Messiah. So, he will show no regard for the Messiah because he tried to kill him. Now, there's another interpretation of that. The desire of women could be their children because mothers love their children, and the mothers of the children murdered in the slaughter of the innocents by Herod could say that Herod had no regard for their desire, had no regard for their children. But I don't think that's what it is. I think it's the Messiah. He had no regard for the Messiah because he killed him. So instead of showing desire for the God of his fathers or for the desire of women, the Messiah, the willful king instead honors a God of fortresses. Now let's look at that word instead. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. Morrow tries to squeeze some significance out of the word, translates it as for his establishment, he honored the God of fortresses. In other words, Herod sucked up to the Romans in return for political power, which of course we know he did do that. I don't know if that's a good translation or not. The KJV has in his estate, the NASB margin has in his place. We'll just take it as instead he honors a God of fortresses. Well, the God of fortresses is the Roman Empire. The emperors claimed for themselves divine honors, and the Romans were famous by forces or fortifications, famous for extending and maintaining their power and enforcing the worship they demanded, the emperor worship. So Herod sucked up to the God of fortresses, a God his fathers did not know. Of course, the Roman emperor was a God that Herod's Jewish fathers did not know, of course. And Herod honored this God of fortresses, this Roman Empire, with gold, silver, precious stones, and riches. Now let's look at how Herod did that. Let's look at the honor paid by Herod, first to Julius Caesar, then to Mark Antony, and then to Octavian, Augustus Caesar. The use of gold was one of the most conspicuous features of Herod's policy. Herod sent delegations to Rome, also to Mark Antony and Cleopatra in Egypt, bearing very costly presents. He named Caesarea on the coast of Israel. He named Caesarea in honor of Caesar. He converted the ancient Strato's Tower into a magnificent seaport. The remains, by the way, of which you can see today. I've been there. It's a very interesting place. Named after Caesar by Herod. Herod rebuilt Samaria, renamed it Sebaste. Sebastos was the equivalent of Augustus. He's sucking up to the Roman Empire. He honors the God of fortresses. Herod built many other fortified cities and named them in honor of Caesar. We move now to Daniel 11, verse 39. He, that's the willful king, Herod the Great, he will deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. He will greatly honor those who acknowledge him, making them rulers over many and distributing land as a reward. Now we have a translation issue here. Let's look at how the translation is done by the KJV. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god. Now the KJV has Herod defending his strongholds with a strange god, whereas the Holman Christian Study Bible has he will deal with the strongest fortresses by attacking his enemies. Now with the King James translation, Herod is not acting against the strongholds of his enemies. He is putting up a strange god in his own fortress. Now Morrow says that the fortress is the temple, which was made a fortress by the Tower of Antonia, which is on the northern edge of the temple complex, still there today. That, of course, was a military stronghold. Herod put a strange god, a foreign god, in the temple area. He put up statues of Caesar in fortresses everywhere, actually. And he put a golden eagle, which was a symbol of the Roman Empire, at the gate of the temple. Now let's look at some translations which favor the King James Version. The Darby translation, he will practice in the strongholds of fortresses with a strange god. So in other words, it's in his own fortress that he puts this strange god. The New American Bible, to defend the strongholds, he shall station a people of a foreign god. Well, that doesn't have a foreign god being put into the stronghold, rather the people of a foreign god in the strongholds. So that doesn't really back up the King James exactly, but it doesn't back up the Holman Christian Study Bible's idea is that he's attacking the people of a strange god. The Green's literal translation says he shall act in the strongholds of the fortresses with a foreign god. In other words, he puts the pagan idols in his fortresses, either the main temple there in Jerusalem or in other fortresses across Israel. Good News translation says, to defend his fortresses, he will use people who worship a foreign god. Again, that's not putting an actual idol in his own fortresses, but he's using people to defend. I guess you could take that as being the Romans, who of course would take their idols into the temple. He's using the Romans to defend his rule there in Jerusalem. But now there are a lot of other translations which do not favor the King James. For example, the American Standard Version says, "He shall deal with the strongest forces by the help of a foreign god." In other words, he's on the attack. God's word, "He will deal with strong forces." Again, he's on the attack. The American Standard Bible, "He will take actions against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god." So again, he's on the attack. The NIV says, "He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god." Again, he's on the attack. The New King James Version, "He shall act against the strongest fortresses with the foreign god." Well, you can see that the translation is iffy. We can go either way, but it makes perfectly good sense to go the KJV way, because that's what Herod did. Now, those advocates for Antiochus Epiphanes, if they want to say that he used a foreign god to attack somebody, I don't know when that would be, but Herod did put foreign gods in his fortresses. Now, the help of a foreign god, that would be, again, the gods of the Roman Empire. Herod's alliances with Mark Antony and later Augustus were famous, as I've already pointed out to you. Now, in verse 39, Daniel says that the willful king, i.e. Herod, will greatly honor those who acknowledge him, making them rulers over many and distributing land as a reward. Josephus speaks of Herod's practice of parceling out among persons favorable to himself the land adjacent to places where it was important for him to control in case of emergency. Josephus tells of this in his Antiquities. Herod would rent out the land to his allies in strategic places, and in return, those who were leased the land got great honor, and they ruled over many people because they were allied with Herod. Now, the Holman Christian Study Bible translation masks an interesting aspect of this. That translation says that these that acknowledged Herod would be made rulers over many, and distributing land as a great reward. Distributing land is kind of a general term, not precise, but the Green's literal translation says this: "He," that's Herod, "shall multiply in glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for a price." Well, okay, you could just say he rented the land out to his tenants, and his tenants were very favorable to him. But there's an interesting transaction, or series of transactions, that Herod had with the famous Cleopatra of Egypt. Cleopatra constantly lusted after Palestine, and of course she's allied with Mark Antony, and Herod wants to be allied with Mark Antony too. And so Herod gave the choicest parts, or choice parts, maybe not the choicest, but gave very valuable parts of Palestine to Cleopatra. And so now Cleopatra had power over Herod. Herod couldn't kill Cleopatra. He didn't want to offend Antony. So he ended up having to pay high rent to Cleopatra for his own land. Instead of receiving rent money, he was paying it to Cleopatra. This is from Josephus, The Wars of the Jews. "He," referring to Mark Antony, "also took away a great deal of their country, nay, even the plantation of palm trees at Jericho, and bestowed them upon her," upon Cleopatra. "He," that's Herod, "also hired of Cleopatra, those places that had been torn away from his kingdom at the yearly rent of 200 talents. So Herod had to pay Cleopatra because Mark Antony had taken some land from Herod. So that fulfills Daniel's prophecy. He says that Herod shall divide the land for a price. We go down to Daniel 11, verse 40. "At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, but the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. He will invade countries and sweep through them like a flood." Now, at the time of the end means at the time of the end of the Jewish Hasmonean kingdom. Remember, that lasted between 140 and 37 B.C. We need to point out here that verses 40 through 43 are a parenthesis. The parenthesis tells of the last events of the war surrounding Israel right before the coming of Jesus and right before the end of the Jewish kingdom. Now, the king of the south here, I'll just give you a heads up, is Cleopatra, the last of the Ptolemies. She will engage Herod, the willful king, in battle. Now, that sounds like she will engage him to fight him, but no, Herod was on the side of Cleopatra. The king of the north will come in. Now, the Seleucids had been wiped out by the Romans in 63 B.C., so the king of the north is now Octavius Augustus, and this is talking about the great, famous Battle of Actium, 31 B.C. So let me finish reading verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south, that's Cleopatra, will engage with Herod in battle, because Herod supported Cleopatra and Antony at Actium. But the king of the north, that's Octavius Caesar, Caesar Augustus, the king of the north will storm against him, against Herod and his allies, namely Antony and Cleopatra, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. He will invade countries and sweep through them like a flood. The he there is the king of the north, will invade countries and sweep through them like a flood. Now we see the instigator of this battle between the king of the south and the king of the north was instigated by the king of the south. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage. Plutarch records that the Roman Senate declared war only on Cleopatra, not declaring war on Mark Antony, because Cleopatra is who started the war. So it was not, legally speaking, a civil war. It's a war between two kingdoms, the Ptolemies and the Romans, which makes Daniel's description accurate. Now, you might be thinking, how can we call Cleopatra a king of the south? Well, the Greek word for king is basileus, which, as the Strong's lexicon says, can be translated as leader of the people. The Thayer's lexicon says it can be translated as sovereign. Now, let's look at some different translations of verse 40. Let's start with the Young's literal translation. At the time of the end, push himself forward with him, doth a king of the south. The king of the south pushes forward with the willful king, with Herod. That shows that Herod was allied with Cleopatra and Antony, not against him. He didn't push forward against the king of the south, did not push forward against Herod, but with him. Daniel 11:40, American Standard Version. At the time of the end shall the king of the south contend with him. Now notice the ambiguity there, contend with him. That could be contend against him, but Herod is on Cleopatra's side. It could also be she contends, she fights with him by her side. So the English is a little ambiguous there. The English Revised Version says, and at the time of the end shall the king of the south contend with him. The Contemporary English Version says, at the time of the end the king of the south will attack the kingdom of the north. There's no mention of the him there at all. The him is just left out. Now, most of the translations do have the king of the south attacking the willful king, attacking him, but that doesn't fit Herod. But we do have good translation authority to show that we can translate it in such a way that it does fit Herod. The king of the south, Cleopatra, will engage with Herod in battle. Now, we have another problem. How did Herod actually ally himself with Cleopatra and Antony? Let me read you from Farquharson, the Scottish preacher whose book was lost for so many years. In his book called Daniel's Last Vision and Prophecy, he quotes Plutarch, the famous ancient historian. The auxiliary kings, says Plutarch, who fought under Antony's banners, were Bacchus of Africa, Tarchondemus of Upper Cilicia, Archelaus of Cappadocia, Philadelphus of Paphlagonia, Mithridates of Commagene, and Adalus of Thrace. Those who did not attend in person but sent supplies were Polemo of Pontus, Malchus of Arabia, Herod of Judea. So Plutarch tells us that Herod of Judea, as was his wont, he parceled out some gold and tried to help out Cleopatra and Mark Antony at the Battle of Actium. Well, let's look at this Battle of Actium in 31 B.C. It's a very famous battle in ancient history, of course. Cleopatra made the first move by urging Antony to attack. We read from Plutarch's Life of Mark Antony, Antony, being informed of certain disputes between Augustus and others in the Senate at Rome, immediately sent Cnidus to the seacoast with 16 legions. Actium is on the western coast of Greece. In the meantime, he, that's Antony, went to Ephesus, attended by Cleopatra. There he, Mark Antony, assembled his fleet, which consisted of 800 ships of burden, whereof Cleopatra finished 200, besides 20,000 talents and provisions for the army. So then Antony left Ephesus. He advanced to Athens. Octavius was totally unprepared to meet such a large host, and so he stalled and avoided battle until he could get ready. Now let's talk about this Battle of Actium. Daniel says in Daniel 11:40 that the king of the north, that would be Augustus Caesar, Octavian, he will storm against the king of the south, against Cleopatra, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. Now, this is interesting that the word ships is used here, because the Battle of Actium was a remarkable battle. Daniel doesn't mention any infantry in this battle. He says chariots, horsemen, that's cavalry, but no infantry, and many ships. Now, almost all ancient battles were decided by infantrymen, but Daniel doesn't mention the infantry. Well, it's interesting. At Actium, there were no infantry involved, despite the fact that each side had assembled huge numbers of infantry, but that infantry never became engaged in the battle. It's quite remarkable. The Battle of Actium was decided by ships, just like Daniel predicted. He uses the word ships in verse 40. Now, how did such a strange state of affairs come to pass? From Plutarch, Antony's infantry outnumbered Octavius. Antony's generals urged him to use his infantry, but Antony was seduced to stupidity by Cleopatra. As Plutarch says, such a slave was he to the will of a woman that to gratify her, though much superior on land, he put his whole confidence in the navy, notwithstanding that the ships had not half their complement of men. As a result, Antony's fleet was destroyed at Actium, off the western coast of Greece. Antony's infantry deserted him. The infantry never did fight in the whole war with Octavius, even after Actium. But Daniel doesn't mention infantry. That's dispositive to me. That's more than just a coincidence. Now, at the end of verse 40, he, that's the king of the north, Octavian, will invade countries and sweep through them like a flood. After Actium, Antony retreated back to Egypt. Octavius followed him there. He encamped near the Hippodrome at Alexandria. Antony made a brisk sally and routed Octavius's cavalry, but then Antony drove Octavius's cavalry back into their trenches, so the cavalry was involved. So Antony retreats to the city of Alexandria with the complacency of a conqueror, even though he had been beaten thoroughly. This was not a smart move. He and Cleopatra end up dead with their kingdom conquered by Rome. You know the story with the snake and all that. Cleopatra killed herself because she thought Antony was dead and so forth. Now, getting back to the countries that the king of the north will invade, as Daniel says in verse 40, he will invade those countries and sweep through them like a flood. Here's a list of the countries. Now, the reason he was doing this is because all these provinces were formerly under the control of Mark Antony. Now, Mark Antony's dead, so now Octavian's got to go to the provinces to make sure he collects the tribute money. And here are the countries that he marched through after conquering Cleopatra in the aftermath of Actium in 31 BC. Here are the countries: Africa, Upper Cilicia, Paphlagonia, Thrace, Pontus, Galatia, other provinces from Illyria to Armenia. Daniel's prophecy fits perfectly. We go now to verses 41 and 42. He, that's the king of the north, Augustus Caesar, Octavian, he will also invade the beautiful land, and many will fall, but these will escape from his power: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of the Ammonites. He will extend his power against the countries, and not even the land of Egypt will escape. He will invade the beautiful land. The beautiful land, of course, is Palestine, the promised land, the land of Israel. Octavian did invade Israel on his way down to Egypt to kill Antony and Cleopatra. Now, after the disaster at Actium, Herod had with great prudence and foresight made his submission to Caesar Augustus. Herod did, such skillful diplomacy that it was accepted by Caesar Augustus. Herod also rendered Augustus a lot of assistance. As Josephus says, Caesar went for Egypt through Syria when Herod received him with royal and rich entertainments. And then did he first of all ride along with Caesar as he was reviewing his army about Ptolemy, and feasted him with all his friends, and then distributed among the rest of his army what was necessary to feast then withal. So, Augustus Caesar was very successful in overrunning countries. However, there were three that he was not able to take. That's Edom, Moab, and Ammon, famous neighbors of Israel to the east of the Jordan River, going from north to south. Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Edom was not only east of the Dead Sea and also south of the Dead Sea. Octavius failed miserably in his attempts to take these lands. He, Octavius, Caesar Augustus, sent an expedition into these countries under a Roman military officer named Aelius Gallus. He also sent 500 of Herod's guards, Josephus tells us, and Pliny, Strabo, Dio Cassius, all famous ancient historians, all refer to this expedition and its failure. Daniel predicted it right on the money. Verse 42, the king of the north, Caesar Augustus, will extend his power against the countries, and not even the land of Egypt will escape. Well, of course, Egypt didn't escape because Octavius went down there and killed Antony and Cleopatra. Continuing with our parenthesis here in verse 43, Daniel 11, He, that's the king of the north, Caesar Augustus, will get control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the riches of Egypt. The Libyans and Cushites will also be in submission. The hidden treasures of gold and silver. Now, Egypt was fantastically wealthy at the time. It had two main sources of its wealth, the grain trade to the Roman Empire, the famous grain trade. Also, Egypt was involved in the carrying trade, carrying gems, pearls, and spices from India to the Roman Empire. Well, after Cleopatra got whooped at Actium in 31 BC, she's desperate to save her treasure. At first, she planned to drag it to the Red Sea, put the treasure on galleys, and then she was going to flee to a remote country. But this plan was abandoned, and then she hid her treasure near the Temple of Isis. I assume this is in Alexandria. She put it inside large monuments that she had erected near the temple. So the treasure was hidden, just like Daniel said. In verse 43, Daniel says he will get control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver. Well, how did Octavius get the hidden gold and silver? He tricked Cleopatra into yielding the treasure out of the Temple of Isis. Now, as long as Cleopatra held out from Augustus's siege, Caesar was worried she would set fire to the hole and he would lose all that wealth. So he continually sent messages to Cleopatra with assurances of generous treatment, while in the meantime he hastened to the city with his army so he could conquer it, Alexandria. But at any rate, he ends up with the treasure. He also has control of the Libyans, who are to the west of Egypt, west of the mouth of the Nile River, on the southern coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Present-day Libya is still there. The Cushites, those are the Ethiopians, to the south of Egypt, along the coast of the Red Sea. We know that from history, that Octavius's subordinate, Cornelius Balbus, B-A-L-B-U-S, conquered Libya and Nubia. This conquest was considered so great an achievement that Balbus was granted a triumph in Rome, and that's against all precedent because Balbus was not a native Roman. Again, all of this fits Daniel's prophecy perfectly. This willful king at the end of Daniel 11 is not Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, folks, and he's not the future Antichrist either. We move now to Daniel 11, verse 44. But reports from the east and the north will terrify him, and he will go out with great fury to annihilate and completely destroy many. This is, of course, referring to Herod the Great. Remember, verses 40 through 43 were a parenthesis, so the hymn there refers to verse 40, and verse 40 was referring to the willful king. As we were going through verses 36 through 39, we pointed out that all the references to a he is referring back to the king, the willful king in verse 36, the king who does as he pleases. So, as Farquharson points out, verses 40 through 43 are a parenthesis. So we're back to Herod now. We finished with the king of the north, Octavian. Reports from the east and the north will terrify him. Well, let's start with the east. There were reports from wise men seeking the birthplace of the king of the Jews. We read this in the familiar Christmas story, Matthew 2, verses 1 through 3. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. So these reports terrified Herod. The NASB translation of Matthew 2, verse 1 says that Herod was troubled. Troubled, terrified. He didn't like it because he thought somebody was trying to take his kingship away from him, and so he engaged in the slaughter of the innocents. The end of verse 44 says that he, the willful king, Herod, will go out with great fury to annihilate and completely destroy many. That's exactly what he did with the slaughter of the innocents. We read that in Matthew 2, verse 16. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been outwitted by the wise men, the wise men had gave him a bum steer about where the baby Jesus was. Herod flew into a rage. He gave orders to massacre all the male children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, in keeping with the time he had learned from the wise men. Okay, so that takes care of reports from the east. How about reports from the north that will terrify Herod? Antipater, Herod's oldest son, was then at Rome. He conspired to have letters written to his father. Now, Antipater was a despicable character. He gave information to Herod that two of Herod's other sons had slandered Herod to Caesar. A lie. These two sons Herod was planning to give the succession to. And Antipater wanted the throne instead, and so he slanders his brothers. And that, of course, terrified Herod because he thought his two sons were trying to take the throne away from him. In fact, he ended up killing them to make sure. Now, one little detail here. Why is this report from Rome said to be from the north? Why is it to the north of Jerusalem? Well, Rome is the kingdom of the king of the north in this section of prophecy. Remember the whole chapter, king of the south, king of the north. King of the north was Seleucids, and now Rome is taken over from the Seleucids in 63 BC, so it's considered the north. Even though I guess if you look at the map, Rome is probably due west of Jerusalem. Might be a little bit north of Jerusalem. I don't know. I haven't checked that out, but doesn't matter. The point is, it's the king of the north now. Now, I mentioned the fury with which Herod went out to annihilate and completely destroy many, as Daniel puts it in verse 44, but it was more than just the slaughter of the innocents. And it was more than the rage against the two sons whom Herod thought wrongly were trying to take his throne away. It was also rage against the principal leaders of his kingdom. Now, this is a famous story about Herod. He's at Jericho. He's dying a horrible death. His guts are basically running out of him, and everything's stinking. He's lying in a stinking, miserable death. He thought he was dying, so he ordered all the principal leaders of Israel locked up in a hippodrome to be murdered after his death. Herod was so hated, he knew there would be no lamentations when he died. But he knew that people would die for all of his nobles and his leaders when they were slaughtered in the hippodrome, so he says, okay, if I'm not going to get some mourning for me, I'll get mourning for my leaders. This was one sick puppy. The order, fortunately, was not carried out. Now we go to our last verse in Daniel 11. Daniel 11, verse 45. He, that's the willful king, Herod, will pitch his royal tents between the sea and the beautiful holy mountain, but he will meet his end with no one to help him. Now Herod had two places in or near Jerusalem. The sea is the Mediterranean Sea. The beautiful holy mountain is Mount Zion. So in that area between the Mediterranean Sea and Mount Zion, he has a temple, one of them was famous because it was just to the southwest of the temple, had a connecting arcade that connected the two, and that is literally between the Mediterranean Sea and Mount Zion, where the temple was, Mount Moriah. And again, I mentioned earlier, this is not where Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes died. It implies in verse 45 that he, the willful king, will meet his end where he pitched his royal tents. It doesn't say so, but it implies it very strongly. Now, see there is translated as singular in the Holman Christian Study Bible. Other translations have it plural. The Darby has it singular, but then in a note says it's literally seas, plural, i.e. the Mediterranean. So even if it's the Mediterranean, even if it's plural, it's the Mediterranean Sea. He will meet his end with no one to help him. Well, let's look at how Herod died in Jericho. I'm going to give you a quote from Farquharson and then a quote from Wikipedia. Farquharson first. Herod was seized in his old age with a painful and loathsome disease, and suffering alike from that and from the pangs of guilty fear, yet continued in a course of extreme wickedness to his last hour, seeking no remedy for his evil passions, but exhausting all the resources of the physician's skill to mitigate his bodily distemper and lengthen out his wretched life. We refer to Josephus for an account of the remedies and expedients to which he had recourse by the advice of his physicians, all of which failed to relieve or arrest the disease which cut him off while he was meditating new crimes of matchless cruelty. Wikipedia says that Herod died in Jericho after an excruciatingly painful, putrefying illness of uncertain cause, known to posterity as Herod's evil. Josephus states that the pain of his illness led Herod to attempt suicide by stabbing, and that the attempt was thwarted by his cousin. Josephus says, in his Antiquities, a loathsome disease descended upon the ruler as a judgment from God on account of his sins. He describes the horrible details, burning fever, ulcerated entrails, four discharges, convulsions, stench, etc. Well, sic transit gloria. Bye-bye, Herod. He exits the stage of history unlamented by anybody. And ladies and gentlemen, we have finally finished Daniel chapter 11. We are now prepared to go to the last chapter of Daniel, Daniel chapter 12, which hopefully will not take as long as Daniel 11. It's a very interesting chapter. I hope you stay with me for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.